Thanks for joining us. It's another episode of Sactown Talks, where we chat with Sacramento's movers, shakers, and eclectic personalities. This week, I'm pleased to introduce to you Dr. Linda Katehi. If you don't know Dr. Katehi, she is a Chancellor Emerita at UC Davis. She served as the sixth Chancellor of UC Davis and the first woman to hold the post. She's also holds a membership in the National Academy of Engineering. Served as the chair of the United States Secretary of Commerce's Committee for the National Medal of Technology and Innovation, was a chair of the President's Committee for the National Medal of Science, and served as an advisor to the FBI through National Security Higher Education Advisory Board, and is a current faculty at UC Davis. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. And, I just wanted to chat with you, frankly, when I had the vision for this podcast. I just wanted to chat with you because I felt like there was a lot of depth to the story and to like what you've mm-hmm. done and what you've accomplished that has not necessarily been covered in the news. For example, you hold, I think it's 19 patents.
Yes.
You were born on a small Greek island.
Yes.
And I think you're one of the only two women to go to school from that island.
True. I mean, I was the first one to go to college
right.
from that island.
What was the name of the island?
Salamis.
It
historically is very well known because there were three major battles between the Greeks in ancient Greece and pre-classic years and the Persians.
Okay.
And one of them took place on that island.
Okay.
And so historically it's very well known, but the island is very small.
Okay.
And when I was born, it had less than 10,000 people.
Wow.
So, all blue collar, very proud, a hardworking community.
Okay, and so I just think that there's been a lot to talk about with you that's not necessarily been discussed before, and I think that this format lends itself to sort of a deeper dive.
Right? Sure.
You'd actually gone to school, if I read, in the 70s.
Yes, 72.
The National Autonomic.
It's called the National. It's a national polytechnic in Athens, Greece.
Okay. And that was during, those were politically very difficult years for
yes.
Greece.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about what was going on?
In 1967, when I was 13 years old, there was a military dictatorship that lasted about 7 years, what we would call junta.
Okay.
And I was born in Greece right after the Civil War, and Greece politically was very unstable for many, many years, and those instabilities were intensified with the German occupation, and then immediately after the Germans left, there was a civil war that lasted another 4 or 5 years. And after the civil war, a lot of people who were part of the opposition were sent to political prisons, and they were left out of those prisons and in the late 50s, really. And as they came out, they formed the central and left government, so what they was called then at the time the Communist Party, because it was outlawed before then. In fact, it was outlawed up until much later. And there were, of course, Greece was a very poor country, and we had a king, mm-hmm. and the royal family was very much influenced by the Western interests. So either it was German or it was British. And a lot of times their decisions, the political decisions about Greece, were influenced not by Greek interest,
right,
but by the other interest.
The influence.
And a lot of things happened, and Greeks were always very poor at the time. Because of this movement to really throw off the royal family, throw them out, they helped in creating this military takeover.
Mm-hmm.
So history is still not very clear of who did what and how, but personally I think that they played a key role in organizing this paramilitary organization in structure that eventually became so powerful, took the military on their side, and then they the generals, as we call them, took over. And that was in 1967.
Okay.
And then for 7 years they remained in power, but in the beginning they promised to do great things for people, and then that they would live in 6 months. Of course, they did not live in 6 months, and then they suppressed everybody. And then there were a lot of, they imprisoned a lot of people who were politically against them, who were Democrats practically. And so that's what there was a groundswell movement to overthrow them. And so when I went to college in 72, that's when it really started, you know, this movement, and started with the students on my campus, my university, that were organized. You know, it was in the beginning, it was like a grassroots up kind of movement with students only. But then it was joined by the unions that were are not allowed to exist, but in any case, people who were in labor.
Like trade unions.
Trade unions, okay. And then other people who really felt that we were not free. As a matter of fact, when I went to college, we could not read books, all books. There were a lot of books that were not allowed to be in circulation in Greece, so we had to go to underground bookstores to find those books. We were not supposed to listen to music that was talking about freedom and other things, so we had to go to underground, you know, places to listen to this music. And, you know, that gives rise to tremendous opposition, and that's what happened. So when I went to college in 1972, for me it was being exposed to a political environment that I had not seen before.
Right. I had read that you had went, that you, in the time that you were in college, tanks had gone through the had gone through the university wall, and several dozens of students were killed.
That night, and as a matter of fact, we had a general assembly, all the students that night, because we heard that the generals were sending the tanks, that they were coming to take over the university, because they thought that we were creating all of this instability. We created that center, you know, of opposition, and they wanted to just get done with it. And we had this general assembly in the morning, and somehow in the afternoon they told us to go out and bring food, because what we anticipated was that they are going to surround the university and then we would have to stay inside for a number of days. So they said, just go and bring food and water. And we went to my cousin's house that was close by this university. We went there and were tired, so we slept for a couple of hours. And then when we went back, around 7 p.m., the doors were closed. And the doors were closed because there were a lot of... there was a paramilitary organization also that presented themselves as civilians, but they were working for the police forces that were arresting people. And the students, to avoid them going into the university to really break out the whatever, you know, the community of students, they closed the doors and they told us to go the next day. So, and there were, I don't know, I thought it were like a million people around that university when I went home. And I went home that day thinking that I was going to go back the next day in the morning. And then at night we heard from BBC, because we could not, of course, the news were all the news that were controlled by the government. So we heard from BBC and Deutsche Welle and the Voice of America that they had entered the university with a tank and they killed a lot of people. So the next day in the morning, because I had a lot of friends and I could not, the phones were down, we could not call anybody, I could not speak to anybody, they put a curfew so you could not go out at night. So in the morning I woke up very early and then I decided to go to the university to see what happened. And my mom came with me because she was so scared that I was gonna be killed or something. So she was behind me. I was running to see what was happening. And then I saw all of these buses, you know, burned along the street. It was like there was something major had happened. And there were a lot of bullets, you know, and I did not see any kill people. But as I went close to the university, I saw this guy who was running all in blood and everything. And he said, you know, you should leave because they had sharpshooters. They were killing people. More people were killed. From up, from the tall buildings, there was a building it was the headquarters for what we call AT&T, all right? It was all public, of course, and controlled by the government. And then on the top floor, they had sharpshooters and they were killing people. So more people got killed that day. And eventually I could hear the shots, you know? And then we stayed under, my mom and I, and then we stayed under a covered space. So we stayed there for some time and then we went back. We could not obviously go to the university, but there were a lot of people. Nobody even knows today how many people got killed.
Oh my goodness.
Because people buried them. I mean, the families were so afraid that if they come out to say our son was killed there, that they will arrest the whole family. So a lot of these kids were buried and not too many people know how many of them died.
And didn't even get the recognition that they deserved.
Not individually, but as a group, you know, they were recognized. I mean, mm-hmm. the streets changed their names and for that day.
Got it. So you, the reason I wanted to talk about this a little bit is because I believe that the events that we have lived through in the past shape our judgment and shape our worldview, mm-hmm. right? You have seen political unrest turn to violence very quickly, mm-hmm. right? And so when you were serving as chancellor, you ordered the police to come in and
remove the tents.
But you ordered the police to come in, but to protect the to protect the campus commons. Is that a good way to put it?
That is so true.
What I'd read was that you'd used explicit instructions to avoid violence at all possible costs. And I'll just say one other thing. We are now currently living in a political environment where, had you not done that, you would be criticized for not bringing in police protection for a large political demonstration, given what's going on in Berkeley and given what's going on in college campuses.
Of course, you know what happens is, unfortunately, in situations like that, it's dumb you do and dumb you don't.
Right.
And then you always try to ask yourself, you know, how far you go in trying to protect a group and then expose in the process another.
All okay.
right. So usually the one thing that worried me is not so much. Yes. I mean, gatherings eventually can become violent. It did not concern us at the time that there were people gathering. Obviously that is freedom. All right. To gather and express yourself. We worried that there were a lot of out of the city people who came with tents. At least the information that we were getting is that the majority of the people who were coming with tents on the campus were not students. And then you worry about that because if anything goes wrong, you know, there was a group of students that participated in that and there were many other students that were not participating in this. And you worry about exposing every other student to a hazard that eventually is happening on your campus. If that were the case, if any student gets hurt outside of the campus, you know, yes, we it is horrible that is happening and we also accept that responsibility. But if anything happens to the campus and it happens because of negligence, it's a very serious issue for the university. So I have to say two things. We were guided in our decision to try to remove the tents, assuming that we would not have any issues hurting the students. But unfortunately, what happened is that the police does not necessarily report directly to the chancellor, and their protocols on how they do things is not designed by the chancellor. The protocols on what the police does whom the police invites to come and support them from where and what they use during an event is determined by the system. And if I know now what I knew then, to tell you the truth, and if I knew how the police was acting and how they were taking their lead, in addition to some internal issues they had, I would not have asked that police to come and do anything.
Interesting.
At this point, I also have to say that the next police chief was an amazing person, and he really changed our campus police 100%.
How did that sit with you, sort of being called to account for, I think, actually, you certainly probably didn't agree with doing that, right?
Of course not.
I'd seen a video of you just trying to get to your vehicle,
yes,
leaving your office, and there was, I think, students calling shame on you,
yeah,
and they're kind of lined up and watching.
But you know
you.
Why that happens. That goes, so these are not the interesting thing, and I'm writing this book because, not that I will not try to speculate anything. I don't like speculations, and I don't like, you know, people who just try to explain a story. So, but I like the facts. And I think everything that happened in my time as the chancellor, they are not disconnected incidents. They are always somehow, there is some kind of connectivity, which is very interesting. And I would like to say that the faculty who really created that strawman for me, it did not start with 2011,
okay,
with November. It started even before I came here, before I signed up to this university. So it happened in 2009. And I cannot say exactly why they focused on me, because we were two chancellors that President Yudof announced at the same time, one for UCSF and one for here, both of us women. And I was the one who got the lower salary from the two. However, the media focused on my salary, and these two faculty started calling me greedy. So I got, before I even came to this university, so I got emails from faculty on this campus and even at Berkeley that were asking me not to come to this university because my salary was way too high, and obviously that indicated that I was a greedy person.
Okay.
But I wanted to say that the salary that I got here was lower than the salary of the person who replaced me
say.
As a provost in
right.
that public university.
That's right.
All right. So I did not get an increase in my salary, but somehow they decided that this salary was a high salary that I was getting, period, and therefore assumingly made me really greedy. But beyond that, the other was more serious. At that time, I don't know whether you remember the politics of the state of Illinois, but Governor Blagojevich. Blagojevich was the governor there. And when President Obama became the president, Blagojevich tried to sell his position as a senator.
He tried to sell the appointment. They had him on tape saying,
exactly.
I got this thing,
and
it's golden,
so
I'm not going to give it away.
So the state put a group together to investigate Blagojevich. Among other things that Blagojevich did in 2003 and 2005, and that was before I went to the University of Illinois, because I went there in 2006, one of the things that Blagojevich did was to put his two nephews in the law school in the University of Illinois. So if I were to explain now how admissions happen, is the following. Admissions for undergrads go through the provost office. Admissions for graduate students, like law, business, and all the graduate students go through their own individual schools.
Okay.
All right. With exception of the humanities, and sometimes if there is a graduate school, some admissions will go through there. So, in the law school, these two individuals, in 2003 and 2005, They were admitted to the law school because Blagojevich spoke with the chair of the board of the trustees. The chair of the board spoke with the president of the system. The president of the system spoke with the chancellor of my campus then, and the chancellor spoke directly with the dean of the law school.
Okay.
And all of this has been documented. Now, all of this was coming out in the news when I was coming here. And I was not involved, first of all, I was not even there then.
But you cast a cloud on you.
Not only, no, what happened is this. Lilan Yi, you remember Senator Yi, who is now in prison, mm-hmm. in jail?
Oh, yeah.
He put on his website that I was responsible for that. So he, without looking at the time, without asking the question about who admitted these people, he put on his website that I was responsible for these admissions, because admissions, he said, were done in my office. And he called me not only greedy, but unethical. And then AFSCME at the time put exactly the same, who was supporting Lilan Yi in his campaign, put exactly the same thing.
That, for folks who are listening, it's not everyone's, I think, going to be familiar with So that's the American Federation of State, City, and Municipal Employees, which is a bit, you know, probably the first or second most powerful union in the state
very
of California.
Very big union and very good people in there. But the leader of that union, which eventually was asked to leave the union also, she was kicked out from that position. So that, I don't know how they call it, the chair or the leader of that of the union here in Northern California, she put the same thing on the AFSCME's website.
Okay.
So then I was not even here there. And I remember I had already announced that I was coming, of course, because that happened in May 2009. And it was June of 2009 when the newspapers were writing all about this. That I was, in fact, first SACB, and then San Francisco Chronicle. It was they were more careful. Here they wrote a number of articles that I was responsible for a rigged system in the University of Illinois for those admissions.
Okay.
And I remember that I was in Greece, and the chair of the Senate from the University of Illinois, the faculty Senate, called me. And he said, Linda, do you know what you're doing, where you're going? And I said, you know, I know there are problems and everything. He said, do you know that AFSCME asks you to resign on their website, and there are 15,000 members of AFSCME in that area? He said, you should not go. My advice to you is that you come back to the University of Illinois.
Okay.
And I spoke with my husband and I said, Spiros, I think we should probably not go. Because for whatever reason, they have made me responsible for that issue. And he said, no, we should go, because if you don't go, they are going to make the assumption that you are involved. So we decided to come. In the meantime, these two faculty were in humanities, were running a group of students who had created on the change.org, mm-hmm. a website, and students were signing up for me to resign for that. In August, the report from that committee came out, and of course I was never mentioned anywhere. There was not even a single line that mentioned my name in the report of the committee from the state of Illinois. But of course, the SACB never covered that.
Right.
All right. They never spoke about this. The faculty never said anything. The students never said anything. And so the only thing that remained was those articles that accused me for that. So this faculty, the two faculty members, after I came, they were organizing. So the student, there was a small group in the beginning, but they were organizing the students, and they had teachings in Morag where they were telling the students that I was unethical, that I came here for the money, that I was responsible for increasing tuition, and therefore that I am against the students. So that's where it started in 2009.
So could I just take a moment to sort of sort of re-verbalize the political context going on around this time. At the time, I was actually working in the state legislature.
All right.
Okay, so I was working for then Majority Leader Tony Atkins. And I was actually thinking to myself in preparation for this interview that I think one of the things that happens is that when you're a chancellor, that's really kind of a political job. You know, there's political implications to that job. And when you would come in, there had been a couple of years of tuition increases.
Yes.
Right? So the contrast of the tuition increases compared to your salary is, I think, compelling in the wrong way for the layperson.
For the layperson. Yeah, yeah.
And so it paints at first glance, a very troubling view, right?
Yes.
And to continue building on this, Senator Yi, who is, by the way, now in, I think, a United States federal prison for conspiracy to sell military-grade weapons to a sworn enemy of the United States, is, in my experience, the type of politician who makes a name from calling other people out, right? And, you know, having worked in politics myself, so I know the type of politician to make a name from calling other people's out, and I greatly admire the type of politician that does not do that. Because that's I actually think that just kind of tears away at our social fabric, right? So you were sort of maligned to the community before you even came here, to the campus before you even came here.
Absolutely.
This is a small town.
Absolutely.
What's it like to live here?
It was very bad because at least, and I don't know, you know, I have to say that there are a lot of people who have been extremely supportive to me in this town.
Okay.
So I have to say that. But my own psychology as I was coming in, when the newspapers were running all of these articles that I was responsible for doing these things after Li Lengyi had put that on his website, and students here signing up for me not to come, there were faculty who were writing pieces, you know, in the newspaper trying to defend me, and I was not even here. People had not even seen me. They did not know who I was, all right? Because that was never the issue. The only thing that was circulated around was that I was greedy, I was unethical, and I was also responsible for all of the bad things that were happening to the university at the time, or at least I had collaborated to that, all right?
Or that you were an example of the bloated salaries.
Or I was an example, right. And of course, you know, part of that. And it made it extremely difficult to tell you the truth.
Okay.
It starts a new person on the wrong foot. It took a tremendous amount of energy from me to be able to connect with people who were coming to see me already thinking that I was one. They had not heard anything else positive, practically. Now, what I wanted to say is that there was a group of students that truly believed that I was a bad person. And these students were, there were these faculty, of course, who thought that the two faculty, and then with a smaller group, all right, but they created this group of students. There was a core group maybe of about 50 people who... the faculty thought that I was the weak link in all of this, that by attacking me, they practically could attack the system,
okay.
And the bureaucracy of the system. I mean, the top of the system that was corrupt and corroded and was responsible for all of this, all right? So they very systematically... kept this building that strawman, and they did teachings in Morag Hall where practically the whole thing that they were doing is to explain what I've done wrong and why I was the person that had to leave the university. The students were asking me, the students would say that you were responsible for increasing our I remember very early that I went to an event in the center we have. It was in one of those, I don't remember the name of the room. Eventually, we gave the name to the previous chancellor. And I went there for an event, and then the students broke through, and they came in there. And I remember they were good kids, you know, they came. Why did you do this to us? And I said, I was not responsible for increasing tuition. This is not a decision I made. And as a matter of fact, the decision was made after I came. And I personally, I have to say that I'm the product of free public education, and I believe in it.
So you get it. You get their concerns.
Oh, yeah. And then they said, well, go and tell to the president to give the money back to the students. And I said, you know, I can do that, and I have, but I cannot tell you that that is going to change. And the students don't know how the system works. All right, they see me, I represent the top of the organization, and, you know, if they have to personalize the problem, you are the person right there. Okay. And so there was, it was very difficult in the beginning, because from the beginning, the students would see me on the campus. And they would come to me and then call me all kinds of names, you know, practically a small group of students. I don't want to say there were many other thousands of students who did not do that. Maybe they did not think this way, or maybe they did not care about this, that I had great relationships with. But it made it difficult for me as a chancellor, I believed, in the beginning, to create the relationship with the campus, and especially the humanities, that I needed to create to be able to move forward. Now, I don't want to say that that relationship eventually was not created with many, many faculty who have been extremely supportive, but it took a tremendous effort, and especially, you know, so all of this was building up until November 2011. So it was not an isolated incident. That's what I want to tell you. It's like you walk up this staircase and then you arrive at that incident. A lot of times I think, you know, that what would have happened if I had not asked the police to go and undo the tents? And I think if that had not happened then, it would have happened at some other point.
Okay.
It was that volcano that was building, all right, that would have to erupt into something. That's what I think. But of course, nobody can predict, you know,
the
future under different conditions.
Hindsight is 20/20. You know, it's something I wanted to ask you, because Davis is such a small town. You just mentioned, like, students kind of breaking through to confront you. Did you ever fear for your safety?
You know, I don't think so. I think none of the students was, they maybe were very emotional about the issues they believed in. I don't think they were frightening to me. Of course, you always, what you worry is that this crazy person from the outside, all right, you have this person, it has been, you know, vilified, and then you always have somebody who will come from the outside and say, what the heck, why is she still here? Let's get done with that. But I don't want to say that I was afraid at any point in time.
Okay.
I was very disheartened, I have to say, and I was always under stress, practically, because it always felt that whenever, during those times, whenever I was getting into a conversation about the university, I was always starting at a negative point. I always felt, at least those who were trying to confront me about issues, that they were coming from a point of total disrespect, or, you know, if you like, a point of believing that I was a person that I never was. And that was really one of the most difficult things that I had to deal with.
When I read about you to sort of prepare for this interview, the list of stories is kind of never ending, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just in this last summer, I saw two stories about your salary and your teaching load. And it seems to me that the media sort of continues to follow you, right?
And you know what is the funny thing about that?
What's
my
that?
Salary, there are 270 faculty that get higher salaries than I do and teach less.
That was not mentioned in the stories.
Not once.
That I read. And I just want to say that was public. Not mentioned in the stories.
And
I
have to tell you, this is very easy to find. It's public information.
Okay.
So, but it's building. It's building the same on the same thing. You right. know, it's.
You're still a foil. You're still.
It's still. Even if I were to get $10,000, it would still. I mean, I was criticized for getting my furniture out of the. Of the residence.
I saw that, actually.
And I have to tell you, this is so interesting. When we came, the residence was 70% empty because the previous chancellor left, all right? They took the personal furniture, and there was a room at the back that was totally empty, the big gallery, we called it. And there was sparsely there was a table that was supposed to be in the gallery, but they had as a table for dining that was, in fact, a table for meetings. And there were a few couches and so forth. And then we thought, okay, instead of trying to buy anything, not at this point, you know, I was coming and then people were criticizing my salary. Could you imagine what would have happened if I were to spend $1,000 for the residence? So we said the easiest thing to do is not to buy anything. We threw away whatever was broken because the previous chancellor was there like 12 years.
Okay.
So there are things that were utilized mostly and then needed replacement. And then we decided, no, we're not going to buy anything. We're going to bring our own. And all of the things that needed to be replaced, we donated them. So the international house that had done tremendous things for the international office. We did not have an international building the way we have right now. An international house was the place for our international students to go. And they came and they were asking always for money. And I said, you know, we don't have money to give, but we can give you some furniture because they were empty. They
kept
things. And they were very happy, you know, that we gave them some furniture and we used ours. Now that we leave, I was supposed to take my furniture, right? Not leave it behind. But I was criticized for taking our furniture.
It was your furniture?
Yes.
Like it was yours, your possession?
Ah, we had bought like what we had that. I mean, what you see here, this furniture is what we had in the house. And so what, we would leave our furniture behind? I mean, maybe I could do it as a donation, but...
Do you want to take a moment to just comment on your treatment by the media in general?
You know, I have to say that is going to take me to a lot of speculation, and I don't like to speculate.
Okay.
But I would say that especially one medium, you know, the one medium mistreated me totally. And I was thinking...
Can you tell us who that is?
No, it's the Sakbi.
Okay.
And I was thinking, if I were to put it in just simple ways, it's not only they were saying that they were doing investigative reporting. It was not investigative reporting because they were reporting even false things. I think they were just doing a reporting. They had developed an idea of what they wanted to do, and they were trying to get bits and pieces that will be helped to build that picture. But I think what they've done in terms of, because I have to say, a student who was not of mine, a student who was very supportive last year, what he did was trying to look at how many articles have been written by Sakbi since I came. And he thought that in 7 years, they wrote more than 87 articles.
My goodness.
And the majority of those articles was negative. And I have a whole list of them. So he created a... and now why I'm going to use those, I don't know. But he did that. He gave it to me. He said, by the way, if you want to see. And what I think, you know, is like it was very abusive. That's what I wanted to say. It was like cyberbullying also. And I hope at some point in time our society is going to be refined enough to characterize it this way and to consider it unacceptable.
Do you believe that a man would have received the same treatment?
The answer is no. And as a matter of fact, I have to say that I was asked once by the publisher of the paper, and I regret that I did not answer the same way I answer now. She asked me in a meeting I had with the editorial board of whether I felt that their coverage has been differential to me because I was a woman. But I felt in my position as a chancellor, it would have been very inappropriate for me to say that. And I said, I did not think so. But the bottom line was that I regret my answer to them because in reality, I did think that they were very differential to me for that. I think there were two reasons. And again, this is my thought. These are my thoughts. I don't have direct evidence. You know, I cannot give you X, Y, and Z. But I think they differentially treated me in the media for two reasons. Because I was a woman and because I was a foreign woman.
Okay.
So I hope that, that I will have enough evidence in the future to change my point of view, but that's the one that I have right now.
That's how it sits with you.
Yes.
When you, and this will be the last question on this, because I think there's a lot to cover here.
Right.
Okay. When you look back on your time as chancellor, the controversies and your eventual resignation, does it all sit right with you? Do you want to offer any reflections looking back? What do you think you could have done differently, and where do you think you'll ultimately be vindicated?
Personally, you know, I don't think I could have done anything differently. I mean, with the exception of November of 2011, where I think that I could have asked the police not to go and take the tents away. All right.
Okay.
That could have been a different outcome. If you exclude that, and if I look at everything that I've done, I think I've done everything the best way possible.
Okay.
And considering the circumstances, but even if I had to go through the same things, I would have done exactly the same things.
Okay.
So that's number one. Number two, now why we all came to where we were in April of 2016, I think the president made a political decision to remove me.
Okay.
Now, the interesting thing is that she has the right to do that. She had the right to do that any moment in time without any explanation. In my contract, it says that you serve
at
the pleasure of the president. And, you know, for any reason, the president can ask you to step down.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a way when you do that. What happened with this president is that she asked me to go to her office. She told me that she had two whistleblowers, one about my family and one about misusing student fees. And because of that, she wanted me to resign from the university. That moment. And she said, and I said, you know, I am a distinguished faculty member, and I have tenure, and I cannot resign from the university. She said, well, it's your choice. You could either resign from the university, and I'm not going to say anything, or you can only resign as a chancellor. But if you stay with the university, we'll have to publicly investigate you. And I was thinking, what have I done? I asked her, what are you accusing me of? She said, I don't have anything in front of me, but I can write a letter to you if you want me to. So I said, all right. And I was thinking, if I resign right now, tomorrow, the next day, would be public that I was responsible for nepotism and I was responsible for all kinds of other things. And I would already be resigned and people would say, of course he resigned because he was responsible for that.
So you felt like you were in a situation where there was no way for you to save face.
No. And I thought the only way I can do this is by, you know, insisting that she needs to go through the investigation. And then we see what I've done wrong.
Okay. And, you know, for folks listening, the investigation would later go on to clear you of the,
yes,
the most serious allegations.
Right. Practically,
yeah.
The investigation, if you read it, it has cleared me up from all allegations. They now, what the news are saying, that I violated policies. And I will tell you very specifically, I have not violated any policy. What I did is follow the policies at UC Davis. But the president does not understand that we are 10 campuses, and we may have a set of policies for the whole system, but the particular policies of the campuses vary.
Okay.
So they thought that specific policies for a campus, and I will describe to you, it was a variation from a policy of the system, and therefore I violated the policy of the system. But I'll tell you what policies they are referring to. Many faculty, as well as I and other administrators, are invited to go to different meetings, and a lot of times they pay for your trip when you go. Now, we had instances where people would go on a travel, they would charge the university for travel, and then they will pick up a second check from the organization that gave them money to cover the travel.
Okay.
And that was investigated. So what we decided for me to cover myself, I said, okay, I'm not going to charge the university and independently get money from the organization. What I will do is I will charge the university and I will have the organization pay the university.
Okay.
Without having the money go through me. And that was primarily to protect, assumingly, my position from being accused that I was picking money from organizations separately, and therefore I had them on my W-2 form.
Okay.
All right. And therefore, then people would wonder, since you got the money and you got the money privately, then you are charging the university, so you're making money out of your trips. And I said, no, I don't want them to pay me anything. I want them to pay the university. Well, they consider that a deviation from the policy.
Oh, wow.
And they say everywhere that I violated policy.
Okay.
So that's exactly what it is.
That's the one. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'd like to shift gears here and maybe kind of go back and talk about yours a little bit more about you kind of coming. Do you want to take a break? Are you good?
Yeah, I would like to take a break.
Okay, let's take a small break.
Okay, thank you. We'll get some water.
And we're back. Thanks for taking the time, by the way. So, you know, I came here sort of somewhat determined to ask you a question that I'd not seen asked before.
Go ahead.
What do you do for fun?
I do a lot of things for fun.
Yeah, how do you get your mind off things?
I like reading,
okay.
First of all, and that relaxes me. So I'm reading a lot of books.
Okay.
The other thing that really I have enjoyed, you may not think that as fun, but it's fun for me, is to re-immerse myself into my own research area.
I wanted to ask you about this. Yeah. When you were chancellor, were you conducting research at that time?
A little bit, but I had a lot of research going on up until I was a provost.
Okay, okay. And so what's that process like of coming back into research in electrical and computer engineering? Mm-hmm. Having, you know, put it aside to be a high-level administrator like this, did you have to sort of catch up with the state of the art, or
yes,
what's that like?
I really, first of all, I have to say that I missed that intellectual stimulation when I was a chancellor. The other thing is that it did is it removed me from my own community, which is
your academic community.
Okay. And that's what happens to most people who are administrators. And then, you know, you cannot be an administrator for life. Doesn't matter how eventually you retire from your administrative position, all right? But at the end, you find yourself somewhere isolated because administrators do not have their own networking. There is no a club of previous presidents or presidents emerita, you know. There is nothing like that. The only communities that remain are your own professional communities.
Okay.
And if you as an administrator don't connect with those communities as much, then you feel isolated at the end. So I have to say, number one, first of all, I truly enjoyed the opportunity to reconnect. Number two, for my own research, it gave me, because for 7 years, somehow did not do much of research in my own area, it gave me the opportunity to go back into it and look at it with a totally new way, and through a totally new lens.
Okay.
And start something really new. And I'm very excited about it. Okay. I've read a lot of books, obviously, and I'm starting something totally new, which is very exciting.
Okay, so You know, maybe let's just back up here because for folks listening, can you, you can probably articulate it better than I can. Can you explain to us exactly what your academic background is and what your areas of research have been in the past and what areas of research you're excited to look into in the future?
Yeah. Okay. So I have been educated in electronics and I do circuit design. And design circuits for transmitters and receivers for communications, for imaging, radar, both for applications here on Earth, but also space applications. So that's my background, all right? And I did a lot of things in the past in this area, especially for what we call monolithic circuits. So trying to make circuits smaller and smaller. So now you can have on your cell phone a transceiver, as we call it, which is a transmit and or receive unit that is very tiny and occupies very small space. So you can have very good reception, all right? Because how do you call your friend? I mean, your cell phone connects because it has a transmitter, sends power, the other cell phone has a receiver, receives the power, and then you use this, and then you manage this information, you turn it into bits, and then that turns into voice. That's okay. Exactly what it is, all right? So so you take voice, you make it bits, one and zeros, you make those one and zeros current, goes to an antenna, becomes waves, goes to the other, becomes a current, then becomes bits, and then it becomes voice. As simple as that. That's the process. Is that clear?
That's amazing.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks for explaining that in a sort of lay.
Yeah, I mean, that's as simple as that. And I was always doing work in the transceiver, so transmitter and receiver, the one that transmits the waves and receives the waves.
Okay.
And then makes those current.
Okay.
I found a way to develop a receiver that is totally different. It has started, it was not just new, something that happened last year, but one of the most recent papers I did with some of my students, it did the pre-work. We realized that we can do things in a totally different way, which is going to open a new space for circuit design. Okay. Totally new space for circuit design. Obviously, things that are even smaller and things that are even lower cost and things that can help us in a totally different way think about how to communicate.
Okay.
And that is not just for communication, but also in imaging. In imaging, when you have a radar and then you look, let's assume that you want to look at forest, that you do an imaging of landscape and you want to see whether, you know, you have vegetation or whether you have a rocky ground or whether you have any holes in the ground, you know, usually for all kinds of, for archaeology, people use that for all kinds of things. The way we are thinking on how to do this now, I think, is going to probably create some capabilities that were not possible before.
Oh, wow.
So that's why I'm excited about it. And the other new thing, all right, that I'm incorporating is that something that we are learning from computers is machine learning. So a lot of times our receivers and transmitters do not have enough capability to recognize things by themselves. They had to take all of this information, the bits, send them to the cloud, do all of this management of the data in the cloud, and then come down with whatever information. So when you go to Google, for example, you type UC Davis, and Google immediately brings the website.
Okay.
Google immediately brings the website because the computers have learned where to find it quickly. When you see something, the computer already knows. That is how you train your computers to have that kind of capability. It's called machine learning. Mm-hmm. And that is done for computers. However, you can do it inside the transceiver. So you can allow this information to be on your receiver. So your receiver can in the future have this information right there and very fast make decisions of whether what you see as a receiver, as a radar, or what you hear as a receiver of a cell phone is important or not.
Oh, wow.
So if you do that in real time...
So it's like combining machine learning with the receiver.
Yes.
It's going to be a smart
really,
receiver.
Very interesting things, especially for what I said, mind detection.
Okay.
Detection of other explosives, for okay. example, for defense applications. But looking at doing imaging of all kinds of things, even imaging on human body to see... You know, because sometimes these receivers may find application on biological, you know, treatment or diagnostics and so forth. So
okay,
that's what I'm working on.
Do you did you miss teaching?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I really missed it. You know, I have to say I missed every part of it.
Yeah. Can you tell us what you're teaching now?
So this semester I started with a workshop and, in fact, a seminar, a series of seminars, and we invited people from all over the U.S. to come and give seminars to graduate students. So it's a class primarily for graduate students, and we practically, the students this time have to give assignments, so they listen to the seminar and then they write. I ask them a few questions and they write about the importance of that specific technology area to what we call the fourth industrial revolution, which is primarily artificial intelligence and machine learning and all of this and robotics. And we call it like a new, it's not really a revolution yet. Some people will think that it's a revolution because it changes the way we live, it changes the way we work and all of this, the way we communicate. But in any case, so they're looking at different technologies and different enterprises, and then they try to understand all of these components of what we call the fourth industrial revolution.
Okay.
So that is one. Next time, next quarter, I'm going to teach a upper level course, which are sophomores and juniors. And it's a course on electromagnetic waves, waves in general, electric and magnetic fields, forces, electric and magnetic forces, electromagnetic forces, and then electromagnetic waves. It's an introduction.
Okay.
And I will do that course. I will do it totally differently from what I did in the past. I will have the students in groups only.
Okay.
I'm going to ask them to do reading before the class. And so in the classroom, we are going to solve problems and we're going to talk about the problems. And the students are going to submit their work as a group. They're going to be with one group the whole week, so they will change groups every week, so they will have 10 different groups to work with, and I will grade them only for the group effort. Now, every student will rate the participation of the other students. If the students were not there, that means zero participation. If the students were there but they were doing other things, not solving the problems, that means less, all right? And I will use that as a weight for the grades that the students will receive. And so also I will ask the students that they can get help from others, but they will need to give them credit. And I do that because my theory is that students will learn better in teams. They will learn more how to work in teams, and they will appreciate the importance of giving credit to people who have helped. And because that's how engineers work. When you finish as an engineer, you don't go to work by yourself. They ask you to work with a team. And if the team does not perform, you're going to lose your job. It doesn't matter if you have done everything well. If you have not been supportive for the rest of the team, so the team project comes out because that's how industry works, then the whole team is in trouble. Mm-hmm. And we don't teach them like that. The traditional teaching in engineering has been, you know, very individual work.
Right.
And I would like to try this one now.
To emphasize the group. I like that. You you did such a good job of sort of explaining what you were doing in a layperson's terms. I would like to quickly note that when I looked at your CV in preparation for this, it's 113 pages long. You hold 19 patents and the publications
about 700.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd like to maybe just pick a couple of those and have you explain them in layperson's terms, if that's okay. Yeah. All right. Linda P.B. Katehi, Climate Smart Agriculture in the 21st Century Global Science Conference, plenary speaker. What was that about?
So, first of all, let's talk about sustainability. That I gave that in a couple of places. So agriculture is really changing, all right, how we farm, how we collect the crops, how we package them, how we process food. It's a whole chain. It's a value chain. And specifically farming, if we talk about agriculture, that's the core, all right, part of it, has really changed the way that we farm, the way we prepare the soil, the way we choose the seeds, the way we grow the seeds, all right? So now we know enough about biotechnology so we can, for example, the tomatoes we eat are tomatoes that come from a very special category that they don't get, you know, real tomatoes, if you go out to other countries, they're not going to be as nice as red and without anything on that. There was over time an effort to develop that special type of tomato that it grows without any bacteria on its surface, without any of these, you know,
blemishes.
And so, and that was done because of how we understand the biological, you know, structure of the tomato and how we now know how to change it if we want. And change it not, you know, using inappropriate methods, just what, instead of allowing nature to change it, you know, over longer periods of time, now we found in greenhouses the way of accelerating that change.
Okay.
And sustainability now talks about the methods that should be used to be able to create a world that is sustainable. And food is a very important thing. First of all, food production, because the kind of the way we produce food is not enough to feed all people. We are now 7 billion. We were less than 2 billion when I went to grade school. We are 7 billion right now, and I think we are going to be 10 billion at a minimum by 2050. Earth does not have the capacity to feed more than 15 billion people. And so sustainability is extremely important. On the other end, so it's about production. On the other end is what do we do and how we produce food so we do not change our environment. So climate change. Some of the food production is the most responsible for climate change. So, but we don't want to get rid of it. We just want to change it so we don't impact the environment. And that was, in fact, so there's a lot of technology in everything, okay. All right, in all of this. How people use drones right now to go and not only just spray the, you know, the drones do not do much other than just getting a sense of whether there is a need for more water, whether there is enough humidity with the crops, or whether there are there is a need to spray with any of these pesticides. We usually don't use those anymore.
Okay.
But whatever they use, primarily to make the quality of the soil better. And they use drones for that. They can fly over, all right, and then you can guide them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when they harvest the food, they are using, I don't know whether you have been on one of these machines. They're amazing. They have GPS. So you know from your office on how much you have gone. And in fact, the person who is driving is not even needed.
Wow.
In the future, you know, they will be totally autonomous.
Okay.
And so there is a lot of technology that is changing agriculture. It can make the production more efficient.
Okay.
And at the same time, you worry about whatever you do that it does not change the environment, or if anything else, that it reduces, in fact, the CO2 that we produce through farming, and it is possible.
Okay. Moving on here, a couple more. A 200 gigahertz triple push oscillator in 65 nanometer CMOS with design techniques for enhancing DC to RF efficiency. Proceedings of the 16th IEEE conference on silicon
monolithic integrated circuits. That's a little more complex, but I will try to explain it.
Well, what does that mean?
So in circuits, in the circuits that you have inside your, you know,
headphones
here, in every circuit in our phone, why do you think, let me start with the phone. Why do you think, or your laptop, when you hold your phone, it heats up? In the older phones was a bigger problem. When you speak on the phone for too long, why do you feel
they heat up? I always figured because it's just working so much and the battery is working so hard, the battery heats up?
No, it's not the battery that heats up. It's everything that is heating up. And why is that? Because your devices, there is a lot of... There are losses in everything, in all the circuits. And so there are losses in all of the amplifiers you need to amplify the signals. So, for example, when you receive a signal, your cell phone, through the antenna, it's a very weak signal. And you have to do a few things. You have to get rid of the noise, and then you have to amplify the signal so you can change that signal into current and then the current into bits without having noise, all right? So when you do all of these things, you have to use many transistors. So CMOS, 65 nanometer CMOS, is one of the newest transistors, the tiny ones that you're using in the system. But these transistors do not have 100% efficiency. For example, to have the transistor work with what we call high frequency current, because that's how the waves that are coming, you need to put a battery. And so you put power in and you get RF power out. So that's how you increase the size of the signal that comes, which is in high frequency. So for example, you know about 5G, 3G, 2G. Mm-hmm. Here, for example, we have a Wi-Fi that is a 2.4 gigahertz and another which is 5 gigahertz, right? So what that means? That means that the signals that are radiated, so you can receive on your phone, you have, 3G now,
right?
That means that the frequency that is used to communicate is about 3 gigahertz.
Okay.
Now, that's high frequency. However, when you take this frequency, the signal that is very weak and you need to amplify it, you use these transistors.
Okay.
But these transistors do not have 100% efficiency. So, for example, when you put DC, it does not all convert to RF. Mm. Part of it converts to RF. You have to give more DC power to get RF power. And the more you lose, the higher the heating.
It's lost its heat?
It's lost, and of course it's money. All right? You lose power, you lose money.
Okay.
And there is a tremendous effort to increase the efficiency of these transistors or of these subsystems so you lose less DC power.
Okay. Okay. Last one here. You hold a patent for a membrane suspended MEMS structures.
Yes.
What is that?
MEMS. So, long time ago, in early 90s, I was a PI, a principal investigator for a project to create a receiver for terahertz frequencies. And these receivers are the ones that we use for space observations.
Okay.
All right. So when you see all of the stars and you see all of these black holes and everything, and you have these telescopes and so forth, there is a receiver behind the telescope that takes all of these extremely weak signals that come from space and then amplifies them.
Okay.
So we can see the images, all right? That's how. So the receivers, those receivers have to be very low noise, so you don't create much of this heat, so heat on the receiver changes into noise, and changes into noise because all of these electrons with heat start moving, become very energetic, and you have energetic electrons in your system that all of that becomes, all right, a noise in the system. So, and these are in very high frequencies. Terahertz is like 1 terahertz is 1,000 gigahertz.
Okay.
So you can get a sense. As you go higher in frequency, your circuits become smaller and smaller because there is a reverse and inverse relationship between frequency and the size of your circuits.
Okay.
And if you start placing circuits on usually all of the circuits, if you have seen a circuit, is all printed on one wafer,
okay,
one little wafer. The higher you go in frequency, and if everything remains the same, the thicker it becomes, it seems to be the wafer. And then, but the tiny your circuit becomes your circuit. So you have the need to move your tiny circuits into wafers that are so thin that can be similar to the plastic foil we use for food.
Okay.
So there was a time when I made the proposal to create circuits that are printed on membranes. So as thin as 2 microns. 1 micron, 100 microns is one piece of hair. 100. So 2 microns is like, okay, 2/10, 2/100 of that. So that's how small those foils are.
Okay.
And we printed circuits on those foils, and we were able then to create a receiver that operated in terahertz frequencies.
Oh, wow.
So, but it was the first time to do that, to print a circuit on a foil.
That's incredible.
And when we presented that as a paper, they thought, I had a colleague who said, well, that sounds like a science fiction, but in any case, we accepted your paper because we thought it was interesting. And then eventually we did that.
Talking about outer space a little bit, I had read that you were inspired by the moon landings to get into the hard sciences. Mm-hmm. You were one of, in a graduating class of 190 engineers, you were one of 2 women.
Yes.
How do we inspire young women and girls to get into the hard sciences and into STEM today?
It's very interesting. You know, I have to tell you, we have to make engineering, we have to teach engineering, and not exactly call it that, but we have to introduce the idea of engineering very early in girls, but boys as well, because we don't get enough students to engineering, period, and of course fewer girls.
Okay.
Or fewer underrepresented minorities. I think here is why. They don't understand it, especially my area. They don't understand what it is that I'm doing. They don't understand what those circuits are. But I was thinking, every kid is using a cell phone, or a computer. But let's assume a kid that has a cell phone. If you stop this kid and say, how do you speak with your friend? How does this device that you use speaks to the device that your friend has? They will not know. Because we don't explain to them in a simple way how communication takes place. And I think the kids are smart enough, and the brain in a 5-year-old, 6-year-old is so complete that they can understand higher concepts. So I have an idea, especially because of the way we're going to do the new transceivers. I thought we can create a Lego type of a game that kids can put it together and create a very primitive phone. Wow. And then play a game. So you can play a treasure hunt. So where the treasure has a transmitter only, you can put it together, you know, very crude. And then the kids, you put the treasure somewhere, and the kids, they have these little receivers, and then they go around until they find it. And I was thinking, this is a game. They understand why they need to do something, all right? They will make them interested. It's something the kids like to play and learn. And I think it's possible with very simple concepts to make those kids feel interested and inquisitive about the technology they are using, because now they are totally ignorant of the technologies they rely on. For them, it's a black box. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so wrong, because it makes them science illiterate as a society, and then you cannot appreciate the importance of moving in one direction or the need into spending more money for basic research, you know, for specific things. And it's a generation that uses technology so much but knows so little about it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very possible and very easy to bring these concepts down to a level where a little kid will be able to understand.
Very good. Very good. I like that. You are, you're writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I don't think there are enough, there are enough books about, women engineers and their careers and, their, opportunities for success. And not too many stories about those who have been successful and about those who were able to be successful despite some of the difficulties. We have been talking a lot more about difficulties to younger girls than we have talked about opportunities. And in my career, no matter how you want to look at it, I think I was able to do things that I would not even imagine when I was younger.
Okay.
I mean, I could not even imagine that I would be in this position today. So I thought it is important for those girls that may want to become an engineer to hear the story of somebody who was able to make it. And I will write my story. I will try to stay away from hypothesizing and from trying to make assessments. I will allow the reader to make those, you know, but I will just write my story the way I know it. And I thought that many girls, I will try to write it in a way so even younger girls, middle school, high school, girls and boys can read it, and they can see how it is possible, you know, to make a huge difference to your community, to yourself, and to, you know, the world by becoming an engineer. I think more now than any other time, engineering can give the way to people to change the world. I really do.
Okay. Do you, is there a date that we can expect to see it on shelves?
We hope that it's going to be in a year from now.
Okay.
Or maybe early 2019.
Okay. Wrapping up, because you've given me so much of your time, and I'm really appreciative, but I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about kind of Sacramento and the region that we have here. So what challenges and opportunities do you see for business and higher education in Sacramento and California?
So I will start with something different. Maybe I will respond to a slightly different question, but
sure,
I will cover your question in the process. When you look at areas in the U.S. that have been successful in growing their educational, you know, community and in growing businesses and in bringing more jobs and becoming vibrant communities, are those that did two things. They looked at their history and took their culture into account, and then they looked forward for the opportunities that can take that and connect it, you know, to businesses and enterprises of the future. So the communities that have been able to do that are the most successful.
Okay.
If you place that into the context of Sacramento, I would say, let's start with the history and then culture. The history of Sacramento is very much connected with the history of food in the U.S. And considering that Sacramento sits right at the beginning of Central Valley, which is the breadbasket, right, not just of California, but most of the U.S., then you cannot miss it but think that that is the foundation on which you're going to build.
Okay.
And food, two things. First of all, food is so absolutely critical for people. It's not a luxury, it's not an accessory, it's very fundamental. Second, that food is the way, or if you work in this area, to because we know so much about the impact of food on health, because we know so much about biotechnology and how to make food healthier, how to make food more accessible to people, and how food can help us address the various epidemics that we are facing as a modern society, I would say that really tells you where to go from here. I think if Sacramento wants to be successful and wants to be unique and differentiate itself from other areas in California, it should do something that is connected to food.
Okay.
And that's what I always thought, and I still think the same way.
Okay. How long have you been in Sacramento now? I guess about seven or eight years?
Since 2009.
Yeah. How have you seen the region change?
Well, in those 9 years, I have not seen much change.
Okay.
Of course, I have to say, physical change, yes, and especially around the new arena.
Okay.
That there has been a lot of physical change. The city has remained a city that depends on the state capital, and it has not been successful yet in augmenting that with something more.
Got it.
And so in 8 years is a short period of time, though, all right, to see big change in any place. So I never anticipated that 7 years, you know, you're going to see some kind of change. There are very few times in any organization or any city than 7 years, unless you were on that tipping point, you know, that doesn't happen very often. But I think, however, that the city has been blessed with great mayors. The previous mayor and this one are excellent. Mm-hmm. And that is a very big positive for a city. It's just that I believe the city needs to help the mayors then materialize the dreams that they have.
And let me tell you something about this mayor.
Yeah.
Because I was working at the state capitol when he was the leader of the Senate. Who am I, right? I'm a no-name, you know, staffer. Yeah. You know, he recognizes me. You know, how are you? Everybody sees, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can tell it's not coming from a political place. He cares about people.
He does care.
He cares about people.
And the fact that he decided to go for the mayor's position, it does tell you a lot about how much he cares, right?
Yeah.
How many politicians, you know, if you think that people who are senators here and then who were the speaker, where would they go after that? Very few people would become mayors of a city, but he cares so much.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
about the city and the previous mayor, too. I mean, very different people, of course, or different backgrounds, but there are people who truly, they did that job. They do this job because they care about the city.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, not to get too political or to endorse all of his policies, but just to say that from what I know him as a human, he has a great
heart. And I know
him
very well, too.
Yeah.
Because he's a UC Davis alum.
Oh, great.
And I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. This is our last question. It's for fun. You were talking about food just a second ago. We are the farm to fork capital of the world, and I like to just sort of ask our guests, what was the last thing that you ate in Davis or in Sacramento that you like really were excited about?
Well, I've eaten a lot of things, you know, here in this area. First of all, I have to tell you, it's not what I think now, it's what I thought when I came for the first time. I thought, this is paradise in food. Coming from the Midwest, I could not believe that we found this kind of quality fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. I mean, you cannot believe that. You have to live in a different place to appreciate what we have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've taken it for granted, of course, that they're here, all right, after 8.5 years, if I don't see, you know, these big tomatoes and these huge, you know, grapes in the supermarket, I will say, what happened today? How come? But this is amazing, you know, the quality of food we have here is really fresh fruit, fresh vegetables. And also, Sacramento has done something really good that I think they keep up with. This is to be able to bring a number of chefs who develop, you know, a different types of dishes on the basis of what this area is offering.
Mm-hmm.
And then make whatever they do, whatever they offer in the restaurants, to make it very Californian, very Sacramento type. That is very unique, really.
Yeah, yeah, it's a wonderful scene we have here. Okay, I think we've covered everything that we've looked to cover. I thank you again for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, any final thoughts, or are we good?
I think we're good. I just want to say that at this point in my life, I'm very happy, really, with the kinds of things that I do. I never thought that I would have been so happy, really, in a transition like this. Mm-hmm. But I'm giving myself some time to really enjoy what I'm doing right now.
Good for you. You found your peace. I like it.